Capitol Report is a production of Senate Media Services.
This week, a look at ways new state funding will enhance Minnesota's great outdoors, including improved fishing, hunting, boating, camping, and much more. And a new effort supports bringing food from Minnesota's farms to Minnesota's schools. Stay tuned for this week's Capitol Report. Welcome to this week's program. I'm Shannon Lurkey. Sarah Stroman, the commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, called the legislature's 2023 budget a, quote, truly historic investment in natural resources and outdoor recreation. Commissioner Stroman joins me now to talk about the funding, the fall hunting season, and more. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Last year, we closed our segment by talking about the new For the Outdoors initiative, which was the DNR's four-step, four-year plan to find sustainable support mechanisms for conservation and outdoor recreation. The 2023 legislative session devoted significant resources, nearly $500 million over the next biennium. How far will this influx of funding go in reaching the goal of sustainability?
That's a great question. The reality is it helps, but it doesn't really get us to sustainability. And the main reason for that is because the vast majority of funding we received this last session was one-time funding. The ongoing funding that we did receive really covers costs increases that we've already incurred. So it gets us out of a hole, but it doesn't really get us to that sustainable future. But I think what it does do towards that goal of sustainability is, number one, it demonstrates the scale of the funding that we need to continue to steward our resources and provide those outdoor services to Minnesotans. And I think it will show the value to Minnesotans of what we can continue to have with that kind of investment.
Nearly $150 million has been allocated for an investment called Get Out More. And MORE is an acronym for Modernizing Outdoor Recreation Experiences. The five categories of investment include accessibility, fish hatcheries, campgrounds, boating access, and stream restoration. What kinds of changes will state park visitors begin to notice, and how is that funding allocated?
So I am really excited about this initiative. It truly has been a generation since we have invested significant dollars in our outdoor recreation experiences. And so this funding, as you noted, across those categories will really be in things that Minnesotans will see and experience. So if you are a boater, you will start to see at some of our public water accesses major reconstructions like we actually have ongoing right now at Lake Itasca, or you might just see smaller repairs, filling in gravel and kinds of things. But the idea is your experience in getting your boat on the water and off the water will be more smooth. In state parks, it might be you get to experience a new shower building. It might be that you get to experience new naturalist programming or interpretive signage, or you might experience the expansion of our all-terrain track chairs. So the cool thing about this funding is it recognizes all of the aspects of the experience, whether it is the land, whether it is the buildings and facilities, whether it is the programming or the services that our staff provide, and actually management of the resources that, you know, foster those experiences and Minnesotans' desire to get outside in the first place.
So some of the nudes, like the funding will go for like the track chairs, like you said, for accessibility for disabled people. But, you know, I visit a lot of state parks. I love the state parks. I have a goal of visiting all of them at some point in my life. And in so many parks, you can tell that at one time, the buildings, the facilities were lovely, and now they're just sad. And there's major problems. And for example, one well-loved park near the Twin Cities has mold growing in the bathroom, and you can see it. Is this money going to things like that? I mean, it seems like 150 isn't even enough for just the facilities needs.
That's correct. It's not enough just for the facility's needs, but some of it will go to those things. And, you know, I like to say that we have the second oldest park system in the country, which is great for that history and, you know, acknowledgement of Minnesota as a leader, not so great when you're trying to use the restroom facilities, right? So yes, some of this money will go to those kinds of facilities. We will also continue to use, you know, bonding dollars, and that's where that long-term sustainability comes in. This is going to be a continual renewal. But our hope with this funding is we'll kind of reset. We'll get out of that hole. So instead of being out here and trying to get up here, we'll now be here and then wanting to maintain from there.
November 4th is the opening day for firearms deer season, but archery season is already underway and it runs through the end of December. This year, there's a change, and hunters have the option of using a crossbow for the first time. I mean, it was for just certain groups, disability people and people over the age of 60 before, but now anyone can use one. Firearms deer hunting has been in decline. Might this change with a crossbow attract more deer hunters? Is it easier to use a crossbow?
Yeah, and I think that was the intent behind it. This actually came about on the Senate floor and made it through the bill. I think the intent is because crossbows are easier than traditional bows, that it might bring more new people into the sport. I think, you know, we'll track that and see if that's the case. We've looked at what other states have experienced after similar changes. And often what happens is you actually just move hunters from the firearm season to the archery season now that they can use a crossbow. But certainly they're easier to maneuver. The archery season is longer. The weather tends to be a little bit better. So, you know, it's an attractive season for people who otherwise might have been restricted to the firearm season. One of the things we have also done is, and if folks are interested in learning more about it, is we did a session on crossbow skills, because safety is still important if you haven't used one before. That session's available on the DNR's YouTube channel, so you can learn a little bit more. But, you know, we'll see what it does to hunting numbers overall.
So speaking of deer hunting, and because I always ask, will it be a good year? And how much has the drought this year impacted not only the deer population, but grouse, wild turkey, many other species that people are able to go out and hunt in the fall?
Well, first of all, we are expecting a good deer season. So deer hunters, including myself, we're getting ready. We're getting excited. I've already been watching for deer out in those spaces that I frequent for hunting. The drought's an interesting question because it really depends on the timing of the drought and the species. So if you're a nesting game bird, for example, drought can be beneficial because your nest stays dry. So for example, we're seeing really high pheasant numbers in southwest Minnesota this year. If you're a bear getting ready for hibernation and the drought has limited your access to berries and other foods, probably not so good. So, you know, I think we'll see over time, depending on length of drought and timing and species, we're looking at different effects. But all of our hunting seasons this year should be good. As I mentioned, pheasant numbers are up in southwest Minnesota. We're expecting a good deer season. I'm hearing really good things about grouse numbers. That has not been my experience yet, but there's still a lot of leaves on the trees, so they're a little bit harder to see, or maybe my dogs are out of practice. But I think folks are already experiencing those good seasons. And I think part of what that drives is that Minnesota has not experienced the same dramatic declines in hunters that we've seen across the country. We have nearly twice the number of hunters as the national average. So we want to continue that. We want to continue to manage our habitat and our wildlife so that Minnesotans continue to have those good fall experiences.
I subscribe for email updates from the DNR, and the September 19th email had a blurb on the DNR's five canine teams. Three dogs are actually trained to sniff for zebra mussels, which is just astounding to me. I had no idea this was even possible. The dogs also aid in finding lost hunters or detecting illegally taken wildlife. How long has this been a thing, and should it be expanded?
So we've had canine units in our enforcement team since the mid-1990s. And we've actually had zebra mussel sniffing dogs for about a decade. So not a new thing, but you know, five canine teams is a good number. The most we've ever had is six. So we're up there. And who doesn't love dogs? Dogs are amazing, right? And their sense of smell is so much stronger and sensitive, so they can discern different kinds of smells. So, you know, I think a lot of people are familiar with dogs that can track people, those kinds of things, but these dogs are trained to actually use their nose to discern different smells, so they can find zebra mussels, they can find evidence. A lost, in fact, I talked to one of our officers, this dog helped a hunter find a lost weapon, right, in the woods. So they're amazing. We are looking into expanding it because I think it's a great way to connect with people, especially when we do those demonstrations like we did at the state fair this last year.
And finally, before we go, a July Minnesota Public Radio report indicated that limits may soon be on the horizon for collectors of mushroom and other edibles on state lands. I was in the Montana backcountry in August when huckleberries were growing everywhere, and I and the people I was with, we just ate a lot. Like, it was great. There's something so special about finding food on the land. If lots of people are doing it, though, it does impact the health of the ecosystem and the environment. So is it time for clarity on the amount that one person can harvest?
Yeah, well, we all love going out and finding our own food, and foraging is one of those outdoor skills we encourage. In our state parks, one of the things that we have to do is balance use with protection of the resources. That resource protection is part of the mission of our parks. So we are in the process of a regular rule update. Periodically, we need to update rules to make sure they are current. And that foraging piece is one of the items addressed in that larger rule package. And the reason is just what you said, the more people doing it, the more impact not only on the mushrooms that people might be picking, but people are going off trail to get to the mushroom and impacting other plant communities. So in our parks, which again have that special resource protection mission, we're finding that we probably need to look at some kind of limits. Those won't apply to state forests, so there will still be lots of foraging opportunities for people.
Commissioner Sarah Stroman, it is always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Good conversation.
President Harry S. Truman signed the National School Lunch Act in 1946 to ensure that schools provide meals for students. In March, Minnesota became the fourth state to make those meals, both breakfast and lunch, free for all students. Senator Heather Gustafson is the author of a bill that expanded the farm-to-school food program, providing students with Minnesota-grown, minimally processed foods. She joins me now in the studio. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So how does this expansion to the farm-to-school food program impact the program that already existed? How is the expansion happening?
So what we were able to do is get $2 million for 2024 fiscal year and then $2 million for 2025 fiscal year, which is great, but it is not enough. We know, especially after the passage of universal meals, that we are going to be feeding all of our students, but we want to make sure now that we're looking at the food and making sure it's healthy. A couple of reasons why farm to school is important is it connects our agriculture to our education, our farmers to our students, and we want to make sure that healthy diet exists for them at breakfast and lunch. This helps a number of our industries, and by expanding the bill, my goal would be to expand it, double the budget, and put it into the base so that farmers know that they have a reliable source of income and a reliable customer that they can serve their products to, and schools know that they have a reliable source of healthy food. So that's the goal.
Currently, the Minnesota Department of Education manages food distribution to schools, with the food coming from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. It's a national effort. This new expansion then creates a pathway, or increases the pathway, actually, for the statewide effort. is the idea maybe that we would replace this sort of national food program with a state-run food program that relies on state-grown resources?
So we do get some of our food locally. It's not all national, but you're right. And what's kind of ridiculous about it, especially if you're out on a farm tour, is that you see that schools are eating, let's say they're having tacos, and the tomatoes they bring in are coming from other states, and the cheese is coming from other states, and the beef. And all of that could just be locally sourced. In fact, if you're in a rural school district, you're surrounded by all of those things that are just simply down the road. In fact, a lot of those students are probably the students of farmers. And so what we're saying is, let's provide that. Let's take out the middleman. One, it's gonna be better for the environment. Less transportation costs is also gonna bring down the costs of doing business. Remember that every farmer is also a small business owner. So that's gonna bring down costs for cold storage, for transportation. Plus, now they've got a dependable source that they can serve to. So yes, the idea is to sort of make sure that our local schools are eating locally, and it's gonna be healthier, it's gonna be fresher. We see some counties are already doing that. Rice County, Aiken County are passing resolutions to say that they would like to see over 51% of the local food coming into the schools actually be local. And so that you're not having to purchased, you know, cheese from the other end of Wisconsin or tomatoes from, you know, California. We have that stuff here, and we can just serve our students here.
So, in essence, this law now doesn't just help students, but it helps the farmers, it helps the growers find markets, and then possibly build production facilities to take a product from its raw material to a finished product, all here in Minnesota?
Yeah, so a couple of things about that. When we are talking about what this does for farmers, there is, and I'll probably reference this later, but Hutchinson School is really a prime example of a place that is doing this and doing this really, really well. And they have taken almost a significant portion of everything I mentioned. Let's go back to tacos, because it comes, there's so many different ingredients in there that can be grown locally. So they'll have homemade meatballs that come from local beef suppliers in Hutchinson area. They'll have, like, the cheese is grown naturally, the vegetables are there. The cheese is coming naturally, and the vegetables are grown naturally there. And a lot of it comes from a place called Loon Organics. This is an organic farm that has been doing this for a while. I use them as an example because, to answer your question, they were spending so much time and money coming to the St. Paul and Minneapolis farmers markets, but then now that's cutting in 16, 17, 18 hours of their weekend. If you want to have a family, you've got small kids, plus just the cost of the transportation and storage and all of that adds up. They just realized that it was a lot more cost efficient to sell directly to their school district. And that's sort of the idea. That's a prime example of what we could do across our state that would serve both rural areas, urban areas, suburbs, everywhere, to have locally grown Minnesota food for our students.
You mentioned an organic farmer. So There is a role for organic farming. There's a role for pork producers. There's a role for anything that is grown in Minnesota.
Yes. Absolutely. And then to talk about the preparation of it, our schools are doing that already. A lot of times they will get in food that isn't necessarily ready to serve. And so that is what our school staff does so amazingly well, is that they know that their students need. They know what they have to do. They've been doing and preparing lunch and breakfast for our students for years. It's a really great partnership that kind of brings out the best of everybody, and also gives us something that we really need, which is, again, healthy food, especially now that every student is getting breakfast and lunch for free.
But the scale is different. So In the end, does this cost us more or less, or is that not even really a valid question when we consider the health of the food that we're serving our kids and the health of our state economy, which is very agriculture based to begin with?
Sure, it's a budget choice. But I think if you take a look at why or where that money is going and how many people it's helping, again, it's gonna be helping with agriculture, education, and job development. All of those things benefit when we invest in this. And what we did was great. It was a great start, but it's just simply not enough. I mean, we all need to eat, and we'd like to eat healthy. This is going to be benefiting three major components of Minnesota industries and helps our kids eat healthy. It's win, win, win.
So there is one new position at the Department of Agriculture that has been created for this. It's a statewide coordinator of farm to institution strategy and programming. So what does this person do?
Well, as you can imagine, the logistics of all of this is going to be a pretty heavy lift. So you're looking at people who have to coordinate between schools and farmers. They have to oversee the production. They have to engage in outreach. I mean, we want to make sure that we're reaching out to new emerging farmers, organic farmers, beef producers, pork producers. That takes a significant amount of time. I mean, that in and of itself is going to be a very busy full-time job. And we want that. I mean, a program that we don't set up for success isn't something that we should be investing money in. So we're going to make sure that it's done right by having that coordinator in place.
Senator Heather Gustafson, I want to thank you so much for talking about this.
Absolutely.
We close this week's program with a look at the career of Capitol architect Cass Gilbert. We've been highlighting the design and various aspects of the state capitol, but we haven't spent much time on the architect. And as we stand here next to this bust of Cass Gilbert, tell us who he was.
Yeah, he was, of course, the architect that designed this building. He had a huge hand in everything. And so he not only designed the floor plans and all the elements inside, but he designed the furniture. He was a hands-on architect who liked to, you know, work with the artists and work on commissioned works of art and ideas and concepts. So his hand is everywhere within this building. And he comes from St. Paul. He was born in Ohio, moved to St. Paul as a young boy, and then pretty much lived his formative years here. He worked as an apprentice carpenter down in Hastings and then went on to school at MIT for a year and took a grand tour of Europe where he saw all the great buildings of Europe at that time, and then came back here and then opened a pretty much a small architectural firm with a partner, and they did a lot of residences and buildings in St. Paul before he was given this commission.
About his European experiences, Cass Gilbert wrote that what he saw there really shaped, the beauty shaped his aesthetic. He came back to the U.S., worked in New York for a time, but as you said, eventually came back to St. Paul because he believed that his architectural career would benefit from a smaller market. Is that true?
Yeah, I think so. He always, you know, he worked for McKim, Mead & White, which was the foremost architectural firm in New York City, all pretty much well known throughout the United States at that time. And so I think he always looked into the future, maybe getting aligned with them or connected with them or even moving out to New York City, which does happen eventually. But, you know, being from St. Paul, he was able to make connections here. He grew up here. He knew a lot of the people. One of the first buildings he built was a house for his mother. And that was, as a young architect, kind of a place to establish himself. And then he was given commissions or got hired to do other projects throughout St. Paul. And then what made him important as an architect was he had this vision and these ideas, and that's where that European tour really cemented some of the ideas that he incorporates into buildings he later builds as a young architect and as an older architect, a well-established architect, known internationally by the time he died in 1934.
One scholar I read talked about how Gilbert was so good at politicking, about cultivating different artists and engineers and other people he needed to create the vision of a project. How does that show up in the state capitol?
Well, he was a shrewd businessman, and he was a part of the Town and Country Club. He was a part of the Minnesota Club. He was a part of the Minnesota Bulk Club. And other members in those organizations are the business leaders. They're the prominent politicians. They're the movers and shakers of St. Paul. So he's smart enough to know I have to start rubbing elbows with a lot of these important people because that's where the commissions will be coming in the future. So he was worked with James J. Hill for some of those projects, and he worked with other well-known, you know, Channing Seabury. You know, he later became a commissioner, but he knew him. He lived a couple houses down from where his mother lived. He knew a lot of the business people in downtown St. Paul. He was commissioned to do warehouses for some of those men. And so, yeah, he was a shrewd kind of politician and mover and shaker, and he was trying to work his way up in the kind of the upper levels of St. Paul culture and society that way.
In getting the state capitol contract, he had to coordinate efforts for all kinds of people, engineers, artists. He was really good at bringing lots of people together for his vision. How did he go about doing that?
Once again, it's kind of his personality. I think he was a hard-driving person. He had an artistic flair, too. He was a watercolor artist, very accomplished. And so he could kind of, in his mind, envision what he wanted for this building, especially the state capitol, what he wanted it to appear. And so you're right, he was bringing in great relationships with some of the foremost artists of that time period. He was, of course, had to work well with that Board of Capitol Commissioners because they're the ones who are actually rubber stamping or saying, go ahead, move forward with this. And so he's building relationships with contractors. And of course, any project this size, you're going to butt heads with your general contractors and other vendors because they're maybe not doing the work you want it the way done, the way you want it done, or they're maybe behind. And so when you read through some of the documents and the correspondences, you know, there are some struggles going on, but I think everyone left this project in 1905 understanding that this was one of the great, you know, projects that as a team we can accomplish a lot of great things. And for instance, you know, he had to persuade the Capitol Commissioners to get more money to put art in the building. Gilbert had already, you know, originally wanted some art throughout the big public spaces, but there was never enough money. There was never really a desire by those commissioners to get that done. So he took them on a junket out east to go to all the new buildings that were being built at this time, the Library of Congress, which was kind of the basic kind of floor plan or the blueprint for this building, for the decoration. And those commissioners came back to St. Paul and said, we got to do that same thing here for our state capitol. We have to spend the money to make this work and make it a very beautiful building. So he knew, you know, where to push, where to pull back, and kind of have his influence is very evident throughout this building by having those good working relationships.
And the Minnesota State Capitol then became the launching point for a national career.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, in 1899, he moved from St. Paul with his family to New York City. So as he, when he got the commission for the U.S. Custom House in New York City, in the letter he wrote to his wife, he has a little ship he drew in the corner, and it says, our ship has arrived. And so they basically, we're on our way to New York City. And so he later went on to build the U.S. Custom House in the early 1900s. He built the Woolworth Building. That was the tallest building in the world until the Chrysler Building came online in the 1920s. And then his final large project was the U.S. Supreme Court Building.
With architects like Frank Lloyd Wright, you clearly see the design aesthetic in any building that they did. But with Cass Gilbert, his is more of an integration of lots of different types of architecture, from the neo-Gothic, like you see in the Woolworth Building, to the Beaux-Arts that you see here in this Capitol Building. Was that a unique trait of Cass Gilbert's, to be able to incorporate different elements for different buildings?
I think it's kind of the time period he was coming up as an architect. You have all these influence of the Richardsonian Romanesque architectures, these big forbidding, big archways of stone. Plus you have the lightweight, kind of the Gothic, you know, triangles and the different lighthearted kind of gingerbread type stuff. And Queen Anne, if you look at his house in St. Paul that he built, it's a combination of shingles and Queen Anne, and it's just a eclectic version of all kinds of different architectural styles incorporated in one building. And so that was, I think, his master genius in all of this, is he was able to take, in whatever project it was, he was able to take traditional elements and make it into a very modern functioning building. So when you look at the state capitol, the goal was to have it look like something you would see if you walked into a public building in Italy in 1500. Well, inside in 1905, you had working elevators, you had electric lights, you had everything that a modern building would have. So he's using this aesthetic of the past to incorporate stories into the future, or into the present and into the future. And so when you look at his buildings, they really are this really kind of a neat vision of his to put traditional with modern elements.
Again next week as we delve into more topics affecting Minnesotans. I'm Shannon Lurkey, and on behalf of all of us at Senate Media Services, thanks for watching.